And then, yeah, here's some like documentation of doing that in different places, making installations. So you've just got like a computer terminal and a set of instructions. And then when people come and use it, they design their diet, it's printed out, and then we ask them to sort of put them on, to re-territorialize a map of the area around the gallery or the institution. In this case, it was a National Trust property, so they had a big sort of parkland for the disappeared aristocracy, which we were proposing to re-territorialize into a community farm. And then you kind of like get people to work through different problems of whether they want to work together or whether they want to become collectivized, and different efficiencies involved in that. So it's kind of a really useful tool for lots of different things. But the best bit about it is this here, how it shows the implication for the population, which is a kind of it's an example of Kant's categorical imperative, which is this like very basic philosophical idea that in order to, before you make an action, you must think through the implications of that action if everybody else did it too. Yeah, and population, of course, is something which is really important to think about now, and nobody does. Because there's something inherently unpalatable to be thinking about the necessity of controlling population in our society, which is governed so much by free will and freedom of expression, freedom to have as many children as you like. As soon as you start talking about maybe people should think about having less kids, then people start quoting Chairman Mao at you. Okay. Slides. Right, so here's some pictures of the site in Cornwall. So the software was basically my way of filling in this knowledge gap for myself about what I should be growing to survive. And then the site became the practical application of that. I tried to, for 5 years, actually sort of realize this model, which was suggested by the software. And these are just some documentation from that. In artistic terms, it was quite difficult to work out how to document this project. There's, because referring back to that first image and the dangers of this sort of romanticising nature, like how could we actually sort of look at this, getting back to the good life kind of scenario without ending up like Hugh Fernie Whittingstall at the cottage or something. So we ended up making this series of photographs which are always devoid of the human. They're sort of like leaving, showing the human activity and quite often showing like the bleakness of it, but never actually showing the human in the photograph. And when I say we, it's because originally I set this project up with my partner at the time, who was my work colleague as well, Kenna Herney. So she was involved in a lot of these projects in the early days. So we planted trees to like, obviously for future fuel and for building materials, and even got so far as doing grain trials, growing crops of rye and barley by hand, and growing all the carbohydrates for the person who was the sort of subject of this model. Okay, but what then really started to come out of this project in terms of the work, the artwork, was understanding that it afforded us a unique kind of opportunity to sort of really try and pull apart this idea of dark ecology and enmeshment. So here we were, these two humans living on this piece of land in a restricted economy, within a restricted system of niches with a restricted boundary. Everything that we were doing was in this one place. Everything that we were putting into the land and taking back out of the land was like restricted to that one place. And the first thing that I learned very early on is that nature has no special regard for the human. And this is a resin cast sculpture where basically every time any vegetables failed in the garden, I would sort of immortalize them by making a cast and casting them in resin and painting them up, and eventually made this sort of quite large installation, which is called the Crappycopia, which is the inverse of Ceres's Cornucopia, you know, the Bounty of Nature. And we were just repeatedly like hammered by the fact that pathogens and weather and pests would, you know, just give us a really hard time. So it was really tough. The interesting thing was this opportunity to understand ourselves as just another species within a system of niches, within a food web, within a biological model that an ecologist would use. We began to sort of see all sorts of interrelationships with the animals and other species or the non-humans as we call them, that shared the site with us. And one of those was the field vole. And these are holes in the grass which show where the field voles exit and enter from their runways. So a lot of the grassland on the site was left to be quite rank, like sort of allowed to get quite tall, turn into hay, and then we would cut it in the summer and everything, and by hand. The result was that the field voles had a really, really great time. It was a perfect habitat for them. And as a result, the kestrels and the barn owls really spent a lot of time at the site hunting. The foxes would come and hunt there. Everybody was really happy. Until we decided that, until we started to reassign this particular piece of land as for growing trees, which was part of the plan dictated by the software. So we should turn this piece of grassland into a small stand of trees, well, not small, but like about 1,000 trees. And the thing was that every time you planted a tree there, the field voles would come and like ring bark it. They'd come through the grass and like cut through the bark. Below the level of the grass where you couldn't see to kill the tree, because they've got this phenotypic kind of inbuilt desire to maintain that habitat for themselves as grasslands. So they were sort of like impacting onto their niche, which is something which you would never see. Like if you're driving a tractor working in a field, you don't get that, you know. And anyway, if you're driving a tractor in a field, that usually means that field has been ploughed already that year, or has been in production, been some crop rotation. The field voles aren't there anyway. So it's only when you actually allow the room for other species to live in these low impact agricultural scenarios that you start to see this problematic, that you're allowing more living room for them, so you're going to end up killing more of them, which obviously produces all sorts of dilemmas, which we negotiated by when we actually decided we had to control the grasslands in order for the trees to survive. We would end up killing these little mammals with the mower, and then we sort of acted out this moral dilemma by creating them a graveyard and giving them all sort of ritualized burials. And this is exactly what dark ecology is about. It's about accepting this uncomfortable relationship that we don't see in this sort of normal modern life, because these things are happening. We have our niche in the living within the technosphere. Our niche does extend out into other biological niches, but we never see it. Here's another sort of similar story which came out of this experiment. So growing vegetables down in Cornwall, I imagine, is a bit like here on the west coast, you know, very mild in the winter, very wet, so many slugs. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you ever tried to grow anything, and we weren't just trying to grow salad, we were trying to grow everything, you know, and the slugs would just hammer all of our crops. So we went through lots of different ways of trying to control them, and in the end, just purely because of their numbers and purely because of time, we decided the best way was just to go out there at night with a torch and just cut them in half. So as quickly as possible, averting your eyes. But then I began to realise that this was really interesting again. This was a unique opportunity to kind of like understand the metrics of this interaction.